Army Nation, welcome to your podcast. This show is about you, your passion, and your experiences. Join us for panel discussions, interviews, fan profiles, and so much more. When the curtain drops, the excitement begins. So let's go. Hello, my friends, and welcome to episode 144, the last episode of season 3 of the KISS Army Nation podcast. I'm one of your hosts, Pasquale Vary.
And I am Clarice Pera. Welcome to the show, everyone.
So what does a public school science teacher and a rock star have in common? Maybe nothing, but then again, maybe everything. The answer lies with our two special guests on the show tonight. After becoming aware of Flip in 2013 from an episode of Three Sides of the Coin and listening to Blow It Out Your Ass, our first guest, John Mikowski, found his favorite band in the world. So much so that he wrote a book on the band, Flip. Thanks for having us. By his virtual side, we are also joined by Brent Ahrens, whom you may remember from a previous interview about 9 months ago. This is his story, the story of Flip, a band described as a snot-nosed hybrid of Cheap Trick, Kiss, and the Sex Pistols. On this episode, we will discuss the book, The Flip Saga, through the eyes of the man in the middle of it all, and how Kiss plays into this story. Kiss Army, please welcome John Mikowski and Bryn Ahrens. Welcome, gentlemen.
Yay! Nice to see you guys.
Great to be here.
John, in the intro, it was mentioned that you got into Flip after listening to their album, you know, Blow It Out Your Ass. So I'm just curious, what are your musical tastes and how does Kiss fit into all of this?
All right, well, the band Flip and I are all roughly in the same generation. I'm 61 years old this year. So I was 12 years old when Kiss Alive came out in 1975. My musical tastes are rather broad. Bryn can attest to this. In our generation, really, there was less TV choices. There was usually one television in the house. So whatever dad was watching is what you watched. And whatever dad played on the radio is what you listen to in a car. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I grew up knowing the music from the 40s and the 50s and the 60s. And my childhood was in the late 60s, early 70s. It was all the pop music. It was my first real musical affections were for the Monkees, the Jackson 5, Three Dog Night. All the AM 70s radio, the so-called one-hit wonders, groups that didn't really exist, like Edison Lighthouse, that had a song, Love Grows Where My Rosemary Goes, and Brandy, You're a Fine Girl by the Looking Glass. All this stuff, very, very tuneful, very hooky. And really, now that I'm old enough, I realize half those bands only existed on paper. Somebody wrote a great song. They put a studio group together, they recorded, they got it out, and it was all about how the quality of the music. Mm-hmm. And a lot of those so-called groups didn't exist for more than a song or two. But as I got to be about, I don't know, I'm going to think 11 years old or 12 years old, I got a drum set. I had a friend in the neighborhood who was, I look back now, was a masterful guitar player at the age of 11 or 12. And critically, I think a lot of musicians will relate to this. My friend had older siblings who were ahead of the curve mm-hmm. in the pop music and rock music world. So you had a sixth grader who was into Frampton Comes Alive and Pink Floyd Wish You Were Here oh, wow. and Kraftwerk, Audubon, like all that stuff going on. I got exposed to it through that guy. Yeah. So by the time I was 12 years old, there was a neat little, like a cubby hole of a music record store in my town in New Jersey. And they had priced the albums so that between the cost of the record and the tax, you paid exactly a $5 bill and walked out with your record and no change. So you, as a kid, shoveling snow for a living or raking leaves or mowing lawns, you gave them a $5 bill and walked out. And I remember that, I remember very clearly, I saw the first Kiss album, and then 6 months later, Hotter Than Hell, and then 6 months later, Dressed to Kill, and they were right where you could see them. And of course, it was very interesting to look at. But you know, 12 years old, you didn't have a lot of $5 bills. Yeah. And so you thought about, oh, should I get, you know, that Styx album or the Kansas album or what? And then Kiss Alive came out. And for the price of 1.5 records, you got the best of 3 albums. And the businessman in me thought, you know what? I'm going to buy that one first. And I have to tell you, I wasn't sold on it. When I first listened to Kiss Alive, it was very, I mean, I say this just very, very candidly. At that age, it was very monotonous to me. It was very rackety. And of course, Gene was at the height of his growly, just sounded a lot the same. But I shared a bedroom with my older brother, who was totally into folk music, Pete Seeger, the opposite end of the spectrum. But he saw that Kiss Alive album in my record stack, and he incorrectly thought I was a fan. And for Christmas in 1976, he bought me the collection called The Originals.
Oh, wow.
With the 3 albums packed together.
Right.
And that's what did it. And even though most fans will say Alive is the thing that caught their attention, because the first 3 albums to a lot of people sound a little dry and sterile, for me to go back and hear the first 3 albums, my musical mind was able to hear what they were going for, what the arrangements were, the articulateness of the bass playing, all that stuff. And then Alive clicked for me, and I became a lifelong fan.
Good story.
And so I've always, and I was a musician, an aspiring musician, like so many people. In my teens and 20s, I had the basement recording studio. I have 150 songs registered in the Library of Congress. I was the artist who didn't know how to do the business side, never found the manager, you know, so busy working at the music, I never got anywhere. But Kiss was a launching off point, and what I always later on regarded as my guilty pleasure, I sort of knew that Emerson, Lake and Palmer and Kansas and Styx and Frampton had a different virtuosity to them, but that didn't decrease the fact that Kiss was always my favorite band. And when I talked to other musicians, I always said, well, there's 2 different questions. Who do I think is the best band, and who do I think is my favorite band?
Exactly. That's different.
Kiss has that heartstrings on me.
Right. It's true.
And it's comfort food. And it's great music, but you take it for what it is. You don't hold it up against Beethoven, you know, or Miles Davis. It's what it is. So anyway, that's where I come into it.
Beautiful, beautiful. So, Brent, let's jump right away into the book. So, what are your thoughts about this fantastic book that you have that we have thanks to John? So, do you feel that it captures the spirit of what Flip was all about?
Oh, no question. The takeaway, one of the things, my good friend Night Bob called me after reading the book and left me a really nice message that I believe I forwarded to John. Nobody in the book talks mean about anybody else. Like, we still get along. And you can see him there behind my shoulder, the bald guy, my little brother. One's my little brother. That usually doesn't work out well. But we all still get along. So that was the one thing for me from my position that was really cool. He knew stuff I forgot. So you got to remember, I've been doing this full time since 1974. And
the Eisenhower administration.
So all of this stuff for me is very normal. Like, people will often come up to me and say, hey, that one show you played with, you know, whoever, you guys were opening for Green Day and you did this and you did that, and do you remember that? And I'm like, not really. But what I do remember is the guy who tripped over the coffee pot in the dressing room, you know, or things like that. So it was surprisingly taxing. John and I did countless hours of Zoom interviews for him to get all his information. but he would be bringing up stuff that I barely had any recall of. Songs, all sorts of stuff. Because I do it every day, all day.
And I would, if I can throw in,
absolutely,
I'd say to somebody who's aspiring to do something like this, first of all, this was so totally organic. Like I already write books. I'm a science teacher. I'm a biology teacher. And during summers when I can afford to, I travel to tropical countries, and my area of specialty is dragonflies. Mm-hmm. And I go to places like Vietnam and Thailand and Panama and French Guiana and New Caledonia and Papua New Guinea. And I collect dragonflies, and I write scientific papers about what I find. And sometimes I discover new species and get to name them and all that. But along the way, I always keep a journal because I'm in these very primitive living conditions. There's no electricity half the time. I have a candle or a flashlight and books to read and a journal. So over the years, in the last 10 years, I've taken to writing travel nonfiction narratives of the adventures I have while I'm doing my research. So I already had the chops to write books and get them out there and format them and do all that physical work to get them done. When I sort of fell in love with the music of Flip, I realized that my next book project could be a rock bio of this band, because I read all the so-called autobiographies of the Kiss members. I read books on Van Halen, on Aerosmith, on Cheap Trick, all my favorite bands, and Hollywood people too. And it suddenly had a light bulb moment where I said, you know what? Nobody's written one on this band, and it's my favorite band. And I knew that I could do it. And my advice to aspiring writers is, know your subject very well before you get started. I already knew their whole recorded repertoire like the back of my hand, because I'm an old timer who has it on CDs, and that's my driving music wherever I go. When I had the idea to maybe write this book, I had met them once when they toured with Ace Frehley, and they were in Pennsylvania, which was a 2-hour drive from my home. Flip had never toured New Jersey. They were a Midwestern act, but I made a point because I liked them so much to come out and see them, but I hadn't thought of the book yet. It was like almost a half a year later. But when I decided maybe I could do this, I watched every online interview with Brin I could find. I found all the online interviews I could find, so that if I got a chance to talk to him, I wasn't going to ask them things they'd already been asked that I could do otherwise. I already knew the music. And key, I loved the subject. I did not have to work at it. Mm-hmm. I already loved the band, and I had a musical background. So when I first contacted Bryn through his Facebook page, I texted him. I said, Bryn, I want to write the book. And his first response was, what book? And 2 minutes later, he texted me his phone number. So I called him. And Bryn, I'm sure you'll agree with this when you remember, by the end of a 40-minute conversation, we felt like we already known each other a while. And I think he was already sold that I was a guy that could maybe do this. And it was entertaining to me because we had been working on this for several months, and I'd interviewed the other members of the band, and I'd met, and I realized Bryn had never read a word I had written yet. He didn't even know if I could write. But I guess, Bryn, you had a gut feeling that I had the ability to do it. And I think we connected right away, because we're of a similar generation. But main thing, I had done my homework. It was really important. I went in knowing whatever a stranger could possibly know. I wasn't a time waster, but I also did it. It was a labor of love. There was no labor involved in this. It was just something I wanted to do. In fact, halfway through our first phone conversation, Bryn said, why do you want to write this book? And I immediately said, because I want to read it.
Good answer.
No. And I think that immediately bonded us. It was like, this is a book that should be out there. And if nobody else is going to do it, I want to be the guy.
My line to John was, like he just said, that we had grown up on the same music. Now, remember when you would go over to a new friend's house that you met at school, right? You'd go over to his house. The first thing you'd do is start rattling through his album collection to make sure you wanted to hang out with him.
To know him. to know who he was. That's right.
Yeah. And so that's kind of like John and I basically grew up across the street from each other. It just happened to be a very wide street.
1,200 miles wide, but it
Yeah.
was, yeah. But John, I'm curious, how did you make that leap from your science books to a rock biography? That's a huge leap, isn't
Well,
it?
I have written two actual technical identification guides. So, like you could buy the Birds of North America, a guide to the birds.
Yeah.
So I had actually written a technical book to the dragonflies of the South Pacific. That took me, in my spare time, mind you, 20 years, 600 and something species. And then I had lived on the Caribbean island of Trinidad on and off for 11 years at one point in my life. And I wrote a guidebook, a full color little guidebook. That's my email going off, to the dragonflies of Trinidad. But these other books
I love
were really narratives, and they were written based on journal entries, but I put a lot of attention into making them an entertaining story. What's going to happen next? Oh my gosh, the bridge that he needed to cross on foot with his backpack has washed out. How's he going to get where he wants to go? So I already had the narrative sense. I also, I think a lot of us with very satisfying life stories, you get these confluences of circumstances and maybe talents or intuitions that come together. And before I was a teacher, I didn't start teaching till I was almost 31 years old. Before that, I'd done any number of things, but one of which was I worked for a management training company that wrote technical manuals for stuff. And I was just a typist back in the day where most college-educated people didn't know how to work a keyboard. And so I had 8 years of experience in line editing. And, so I was just paid to type. But I could go to the writers and say, did you mean to say doesn't happen? Because you wrote does, and it doesn't make sense. So I had years of knowing how to make things clear and concise. And all the books I've written, I'm my own editor, and I'm my own typesetter, and I'm my own formatter, and I make my own covers. And I'm not saying that's necessarily the best way to do it, but I mean, this physically. Now, Bryn's brother, Kai, who's a well-respected graphic artist, did our outside cover. Okay. And the band supplied me with all the photographs. So I credit them with all of that. But everything else about the physical format of this book and the typesetting and everything was done on my computer in Microsoft Word. And with s slight reservations, I'm willing to bet that if this book ever gets looked at by somebody in the actual publishing business, they're going to say to me, "Nice job. Who's your editor?" And that comes from my previous experience.
Right. Yeah.
So anyway, this is a very long answer to your short question. How did I make the jump from science writing to that? Well, I had had a couple years of writing narrative nonfiction to try to be engaging and interesting that way. So, and of course, as I said, I'd read all these other music bios and stuff. And I guess I haven't said this in so many words, but again, to people out there who are thinking of similar projects, I loved the band so much that I had an intuitive sense. What would a fan want this book to be?
Right.
Imagine if you had the opportunity to write the Kiss bio you wanted and be able to get unlimited hours of Zoom meets with Paul, Gene, Ace, and Peter. You know exactly what you'd put in that book that nobody else quite managed to put in there. I don't need all this stuff. I don't need all that stuff. I want more of this. I mean, Ace Frehley's book, right? If you could have got him, what else would you have put in there? There was
Yeah.
so much of, I'm not so clear about this. I'm not so clear about that. Well, as Bryn said, he doesn't remember 30 years of every detail. But I had the ability to listen to all their music and say, now, who's playing drums on that track? Because it doesn't sound like Kilo. And Bryn would say, you're right, we used a machine on that. I could hear it. And I mean, th there's one little bit of one little track that's a Casio drum machine, but I mean, I guess that's it, is I went into the book thinking, what would I want it to be? There's got to be a couple hundred or who knows, a couple thousand Flip fans out there that when they say, wow, somebody finally wrote a book about my favorite band, I wanted to make sure everything was in there. One feature that I knew I wanted in there from the very, very beginning was every single song lyric side by side with band commentary on what they were thinking and doing when they did that particular song.
Wow.
I would love to see that in a Kiss book.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, they might not have detailed things to say about Got Love for Sale, you know, right. Kiss. But if you pay attention to Flip, you know there's some serious stuff behind 99% of those songs.
Right, right.
They sound loose and crazy party frat boy band, but when you pay attention to the lyrics, they're talking about stuff.
Mm-hmm. And Bryn, I have a question for you. You know, obviously you were interviewed for the book. So were other members of the band and many other people. Did you have any other creative input into the writing of this book or what went into the book?
None. As a matter of fact, I made an effort to. An interesting thing happened. When word started to get out that John was writing the book, I started getting messages from people that may have done, may or may not have worked for the band at one time or another and wanted to be included, you know? And that's more pressure than I can take on. I can't take responsibility for every person that was on a Flip payroll after the fact. So John immediately took the helm and just said, you know, he was the gatekeeper as far as like who's going to be interviewed for the book, who he wants to talk to, what he wants to talk about. I had nothing to do with any of it other than being the front man for the band and writing the material and writing the songs.
Okay. And I'd like to chime in. By now, I have no shortage of things I can say. I'm sorry. I'm a school teacher. I do 7 hours a day of talking.
I hear you.
But one thing I'm very proud about, not for myself, but for the book as a product, nobody in the band exercised even 1 ounce of editorial control over it. They seem to have felt that I could do this as somebody who loved their work. They were everybody in the band, former members, current members, people in the stage crew, people in the touring crew. They seemed to buy into where my heart was at. They were absolutely open and candid. And not once did somebody say, please don't put that in the book. Not once did anybody, including Bryn, say, talk to this person, but don't talk to that person. They just let me do it. And I did send a draft to the major players in the band. And they all expressed that they enjoyed it. Not one of them said, can you remove that? Or can you do more of that? So as Bryn sort of intimated, there's going to be probably a couple people who said, gee, he never talked to me, but it wasn't intentional.
Okay.
I approached the band. The band was not looking for an author. It had never occurred to them, or it didn't in any structured way occur to them. I approached them and said, I want to write this book. And they all said, cool. And during these various interviews, people would say, well, have you talked to Night Bob? He'll not probably know the answer to that question. Some of the major players are just gone now. Some people I really had to track down. And at one point, we were far enough along that we decided to announce that the book was in production. And there were a couple of people who really had a long-term role with the band. And it wasn't necessarily them, but people that knew them who said, I didn't notice that so-and-so was mentioned. And I emailed Bryn and said, how do I get in touch with so-and-so? Because it wasn't my intention to exclude anybody or include anybody. Right. So we did. I added a chapter with some of the other people that had felt, gee, we didn't get talked to. Because I wanted the full story. But also, as Bryn suggested, at some point you say, we've got the story now. You know there's going to be somebody who maybe was just a diehard fan, and maybe a little bit more than a fan, somebody who was always in the room. But how many stories can you include? At some point, I just decided, well, I think we have the story. If I keep going, we'll never get it done. So we had something I was happy with. But it really was all in my hands when it came to that. Nobody in the band said, add this, take this out, or now we're done. They really just looked at it and said, this is nice. And I'm proud of the whole organization.
And, you know,
that.
John, I think that makes the book even, you know, so special, because it's written in such a unique way, and that you even left, you know, all the commentaries unaltered, unchanged. So why did you choose to do that?
It just seems so authentic. I think when that, was it on A&E, the KISS last documentary thing? Everybody's, I'm going to speak for the world on this. Everybody's favorite moment in that was Gene and Paul sitting in that living room with Paul with his bare feet on the sofa.
Right. Yeah.
Who wouldn't love 1 hour of watching Gene, Paul, Ace, and Peter relaxed, not angry, sitting around a fireplace and laughing about their memories about the band for a couple hours? And who among us wouldn't do 10 hours of that if we could get 10 hours of it, make it a weekly series? So as I started interviewing people, I think I had from the beginning that I was going to do it in their words anyway, because I was recording at a Zoom meets, which meant I had the liberty of watching it the next day and transcribing it exactly in their words to make sure my facts were straight. You really hear their separate personalities. And I just intuitively felt it would feel like the fans were sitting around the fireplace with their four musicians talking. Now, mind you, there's still a lot of work in that, because I wasn't interviewing them in sequence and they weren't remembering things in a linear fashion. You know, I'd be talking to the bass player for the second or third time, and then I'd say, oh, tell me what you remember about, you know, Woodstock 99. And so the different bits I had to pull, you know, I'd have them all in Microsoft, and I'd highlight all the Woodstock bits in green from everybody's interviews. And I'd highlight all the Obsession stories from when they were in Minneapolis in blue. And I'd highlight all the Rattlin' Bone stuff from New York City in pink. And I could put it all together. There's a lot of art to making it a flowing narrative. But I just thought hearing it in their voices really did it. It's the way a fan wants it. It's the way a fan wants it.
That's right.
Especially as I'm not a Minneapolis kid. Who needs some kid from New Jersey telling a Minneapolis fan what it was like in Minneapolis? Let Cherry and Kilo and Kai tell you what it was like in Minneapolis.
Right. Yeah. And Brian, do you think that this style that John, you know, chose to write the book was necessary to tell the Flip story the way it is?
Absolutely. I couldn't be happier. I wouldn't have anything to compare it to other than other books I've read. I'm reading the Geddy Lee book right now.
Okay.
A really good one.
I am flabbergasted that he was like doing cocaine and shit. I couldn't believe that. I'm
not
like,
not me, Geddy Lee.
Yeah, not John.
I want to clarify that in case my students watch this.
That just stunned the crap out of me. I was like, I thought you were the other guys. You know? But yeah, it's humbling. You know, it's embarrassing. It's hard. It's even a little bit hard to talk about because, frankly, I'm usually at no shortage of wanting to talk about myself, but it's just kind of like, there's a great line in the Pee-wee's Big Adventure movie where Dottie goes, Pee-wee, don't you want to go see the movie? And it's about him. And he goes, Dottie, I don't have to see it. I lived it.
That's right.
And that's kind of, I get that.
So, Brent, I want to know, because I recently saw a documentary on Woodstock 99 on Netflix, And it was also mentioned in this book, obviously. And after watching that documentary, it was insane. And you were there. So what was your experience like at Woodstock 99?
My fate, well, first of all, to win over, so we were the first or second like national act on the main stage. We had a hit song. Freak was a hit at that time. The thing first I remember going out on the giant stage, and the audience was a good 40 yards, 30 yards from the front edge of the stage to where the audience was. So that felt a slightly foreign, bigger gap than usual. But we had them immediately. The crowd was with us immediately. It might have had something to do with after the first song when I announced that we had free marijuana for everybody. And all the people started rushing towards our stage. And so that was cool. But the one thing I remember the most, and you might have to help me out here, because Joel Rosenberg, one of the guys who put on the original, all the Woodstocks, and I can never remember his name, Kai's buddy, the guy who put on Woodstock, who always looks like Roger Daltrey to me.
I'm looking it up in the book right now. See if I can find it.
Yeah.
For some reason, I can't remember his name. So you watched the documentary where the fires,
Yeah.
with the fires. So Joel and the person's name that's escaping me, who is kind of like really the face of Woodstock. He's like the main guy.
Michael Lang.
Michael Lang. Yay. So it was on an old airfield. So it was an all concrete ground, right? And that's surprising how much that'll take out of you walking around for a couple of days on concrete. Well, after our show, they invited us up to their office. Again, it was an airfield. So their office was the lookout tower with a 360-degree glass overlook over the whole thing. And we may or may not have been smoking a joint with them. And their back was to the window. And it may or may not have been their pot. And their back was to the window. And we're like passing it around. And I see the fires behind them. And they're both facing me with their back to the window, and the fires are clear as a bell to me. And I remember thinking to myself, should I say something? It's too obvious. They know it's going on, but I think their thinking was first that pot is more important. No. That they knew that people would just kind of take care of themselves. That was kind of the vibe I got. And that if they tried to implement some sort of something or other to curb the situation, it could have caused more problem than good. Now, that being said, here's my take on that documentary. There has been so many Woodstock documentaries made that if we were in a marketing meeting and we wanted to do one more Woodstock documentary, we would need a new angle. And that new angle was like the dark side. I played a gazillion festivals, and I can tell you that that documentary could have been made about a million festivals. I've seen people wallowing in feces on the ground, thinking it was a mud puddle, all that stuff. That's not all that unique. And the other thing I do remember about it was at the end of the whole festival, and Kai and I were walking around the grounds, and it was littered with garbage on the ground, right? And all of a sudden, a camera guy comes up on me, and I decide to pretend I'm like a Woodstock guy on acid. And I go down to the ground, and the guy with the camera follows me down to the ground. And I pick up a little piece of garbage really slow, and I look underneath it. And then I kind of look around, just like some freaked out dude, you know, and I do it a few times. And the guy's like filming me. And finally I stand up, and he's got the camera like right in my face. And I just said, psych! I think Kai got a little upset at that maneuver. Those are the things I remember about Woodstock. Again, they're more the guy who tripped over the coffee pot in the dressing room sort of scenarios. But yeah, it was it. I'm really proud to have done it, certainly. Cool. And the Insane Clown Posse went on right after us. And I remember a stunt that they pulled, which I thought was purely brilliant. And still to this day, I don't think the audience understood what they were doing. They very much like the original Alice Cooper would antagonize their audience to try to get a reaction, where Alice was almost revealing people to themselves. Mm-hmm. So the Insane Clown Posse comes on stage and they start throwing like these little rubber balls you can get at a grocery store for a dollar with a dollar bill taped to them. And they kick out like 20 of those, right? And people are grabbing them and pulling the dollar off. Well, then they go back and they get a slightly larger ball. And all these balls now have $10 bills on them. And they kick out 20 of those. And then they bring out a slightly larger ball. And all of these balls have $50 bills taped on them. Now, people are literally trying to kill each other to get the $50 off this bill, not caring at all about the person next to them, in front of them, behind them. They're just like ripping each other's heads off to get this money. Then they bring out like five beach balls, and they tape $100 bills out of them and kick them out into the audience. I'm standing on the side going, this is like performance art. This is
right. This
is brilliant. But I remember just watching people rip each other apart to get at this $100 bill, which is like, John can help me, is antithesis the right word? It's literally the opposite of what kind of Woodstock, the idea of what it stands for.
Yeah,
right.
Peace and togetherness and all that stuff. So I found that really interesting. Mm-hmm. That really stuck out to me.
So, John, let me just touch on KISS again. So there are a lot of KISS references in your book. Mm-hmm. So can you tell our listeners how you included KISS in this story?
Yeah, I'll try to keep this shorter than most of my responses. could happen. Really, as I've already revealed, I was a KISS fan growing up. But actually, KISS is in the book because the guys in Flip were KISS fans. I didn't introduce KISS into the dialogue, as every time I interviewed somebody, they said, oh, when Hotter Than Hell came out, I was a convert. Oh, when I first saw KISS, I was a convert. Oh, my older brother went to the KISS concert, but I wasn't allowed to go. But so I think KISS is in there because the band referred to them almost in equal the way they mentioned Alice Cooper or Aerosmith. Or the New York Dolls. Hello, Bryn, the New York Dolls. How about Alex Harvey, Bryn, who I have yet to learn much about except for what Bryn keeps talking about. KISS is in there because the band loved them. But in concert with things I've said previously, I think that was part of our connection, the way we got along. And Bryn is here with us. But I'm telling you, I spent dozens of hours with everybody else as well. And we all connected very well. And part of that was we were just speaking the same musical language, and KISS was certainly a part of that. KISS, Cheap Trick, Aerosmith, all the 70s stuff.
Mm-hmm. Stars.
Yes. Right. Stars, another Bill of Coin act. Mm-hmm. That was the language we all spoke. Mm-hmm. And then, as you know, Bill of Coin himself comes into the picture.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So it was a common language we all had, but I didn't need to introduce it. It was just there. It was there from the band.
It was part of the dialogue. Okay. Yep.
Plus, we met at an Ace Frehley show.
True. Absolutely.
So, Brent, Flip is described as the snot-nosed hybrid of Kiss. Could you tell us what that exactly means?
No.
It was my words for begin from the beginning.
What
He
does
didn't
it
say it,
mean?
I said it,
So,
but
what does it mean?
well, having grown up on Kiss, see, I was lucky enough to get the first Kiss record before it hit the stores. Back in the day, Columbia House Records, remember? 12 records for a penny, that kind of thing. And then they would do advance sales on records before they even came out. And they usually did kind of a, if you like this, you might like this sort of thing. And I remember seeing it next to Alice Cooper, Love It to Death, and like going, oh, that's cool. And one of my neighbors, guy by the name of Johnny Johnson, in my small town of North St. Paul in 1970, what
Whatever.
year did that first one come out?
Seventy
Four?
four,
70,
seventy
74,
four.
four, yeah.
'74. He got it. He got the record. And it started back then, you would borrow it, the records would make their way around the neighborhood. And incidentally, Johnny Johnson had a band called Diamond. And when I was in grade school, I would watch them practice by peeking through their basement window. Johnny Johnson used to paint his face half black and half white. That's where I got that from. So when I did the My Generation video for RCA Records, which was meant for another artist, but I wasn't going to return back to New York with unfinished works. And my light guy asked to film something. I went, I'm going to do Johnny Johnson makeup for the hell of it. Kilo's rehearsal facility, the Sound Gallery warehouse, was, excuse me, right downtown Minneapolis. So all the theater makeup places were like only a half a block away from me. So I just went and got it and did it, and it stuck. And it's just kind of funny. So the snot nose irreverence thing, well, I guess what I went off on a tangent, it's just a part of, I loved Kiss. I loved the New York Dolls. I loved the Sex Pistols. I love Aerosmith back then. It's like if you put all those things in a blender and spit them out, I mean, I think that's pretty much what you're going to get is a snot-nosed, irreverent version of Kiss. Quite frankly, there's not a whole lot of difference between the Sex Pistols and Kiss. There really isn't, especially when you consider the fact that Paul Stanley decided to take the word Sex Pistol and write a song about it called Love Gun.
Right on.
Industry secret.
I gotta say, I'm looking at myself on this Zoom thing, and around the holidays, people always send me photos of Heat Miser from that cartoon going, you look like Heat Miser.
You got the hair going.
The
Yeah,
hair's
hair going.
like flaming, like.
The background's making your hair flame.
Yeah,
I love
we're a couple of misfits, just a couple of nitwits.
it. So, John, right now, Ace Frehley is bigger than ever with this release of 10,000 Volts, and he also plays a part in this book. How does Ace play a part?
For me personally, the first time I became aware of Flip, as you know, around 2013, became a fan. In 2022, they released their first album in many years called Too Dumb to Quit. And they arranged a tour as opening act for Ace Frehley. One of their shows is in Eastern Pennsylvania, which is the very first time since I became aware of the band that they were within driving distance of my home. So my best friend, who was in one of the bands with me after college, and who's followed my odyssey with Flip all this time, I said, oh, it was a 2-hour drive. I said, let's go see him. We went to see Flip, really. Ace Frehley was, sorry, Kiss podcast, secondary consideration. I was a Kiss fan, but Flip was that once in a lifetime opportunity for me, not being in the Midwest. So we went to see him. when they were touring with Ace, and Flip did a half hour set. And then they were in the lobby during the intermission. I got to meet him, take a picture, you know, and just get autographs signed and all that. Then Ace did his thing. And after Ace's set kind of settled down a little bit, my friend was stretching his legs. He wasn't interested in Ace at all. He wasn't a Kiss fan, really. And he said, you know, Flip is out in the parking lot right now, if you want to hang out with him. So we did. We went out and we just talked with them for a half hour there. It was such a comfortable, wonderful conversation. And as I said, I hadn't even hatched the idea of writing a book yet. Mm. It was just fun to be there with these guys whose music I admired. And the names have barely been said. I need to make sure the names get said. Bass player, Greg Cherry Forever Item. Drummer, Kilo Bale, Eric Brettel. Guitar player, Eric Mono Vobeja. These guys are brilliant. There have been other players over the years. These guys all have nearly as strong an element in this book. Bryn is the guy who winds up doing the interviews, and he deserves all the credit he can get, but I don't want those guys to be unsung heroes. Mm. They're magnificent. They're all virtuosos. I mean, one of the things about this band is if you stop and listen to it, it's every last one of them. They're such talented people. And they were all so friendly and open. And we're hoping to do a book signing in April. And it's going to be a joy to meet them all again in person 2 years later, when we all know each other so much better mm-hmm. from all these interviews. They're looking forward to it.
Nice.
Anyway, another long answer to your short question.
Not at all.
Ace comes into it because the band toured. And it's not the only time that Bryn has toured with Ace. He toured, was it with Flip that you toured on the Just for Fun tour? Or was it with Obsession or Rattlin' Bones?
Rattlin' Bones when I lived in New York City.
In 1992, Just for Fun, right?
Yep. With our good friend Bill Baker.
Keeping to the Kiss theme, Bryn, we talked about this in our last interview. Remind our listeners, how did Bill O'Coyne play a role in Flip?
In the late 80s, mid to late 80s, 87 perhaps, Bill was brought in by my then manager, Herb Gart, who is my favorite manager I ever had. Love you, Bill, but Herb Gart was so funny, it was crazy. Herb brought in Bill.
Where is he? Herb Gart's. In one of these pictures here. Where is he? There he is.
There he is. Hi, Herb.
Rest in peace.
He had some of the funniest story. He did some of the craziest, funniest stuff. It made our band pale. Anyway, he brought in Bill O'Coyne to check us out. He wanted to get some assistance in the management department. Now, Bill lived in Hollywood, Florida, and Herb lived in Hellertown, Pennsylvania. I can't believe I just remembered Hellertown. There's Bill. Hi, Bill. We love you, Bill. And at that time, I was just the rhythm guitar player, songwriter guy in the band. Didn't even have a microphone, never sang a backup, you know, and now we know why.
Too late.
So we get done with our first little showcase with Bill, and of course I'm anxious to talk to him and ask him all sorts of top secret Kiss questions. And the first thing he turns to me and he says, you know, I know you're not the singer in the band, you're the guitar player, but you're the front man of this band. And that, I kind of went, wow. Kind of like maybe Pete Townsend is to Roger Daltrey, right? Mm-hmm. Or Pete Townsend ultimately, or Angus Young. They're kind of the front guys of the band, even though they're not the singers. So after the whole RCA Records thing, and when I handed in the My Generation video along with all the other stuff, they literally offered me a deal, like, right on the spot. And that was when I knew that I had to take the front position, be the front man. You know, I'm going to have to, for lack of a better term, sing. And you might notice, John, when I finally opened the book up, I told John a joke, like right at the very beginning. I said, you know, I'm not the worst singer in the world, but one of these days, Vince Neil and Bret Michaels are going to die. Then I will be the worst singer in the world. I thought it was awesome. And he put that as the very first thing in the book. I laughed my butt off when I opened it. I was so happy. So when I had to start putting Flip together, I was like, you know, Bill Acoin called me a front guy. So there's something that Bill is inherently understanding here that I don't understand. So maybe he should be the guy. And we got along great. And then we just started talking and meeting a lot. And we just got along really great. You know, Bill, was he a multi-millionaire? The answer is yes. But I once asked him, and I worked with him for freaking 20 years. I once asked him, I said, Bill, so we've been in a lot of different situations together, and I've noticed that you have more fun when you're hanging out with what I will call middle-class, salt-of-the-earth-ish people. I'll even take the word middle class out of there. Just kind of salt versus like high pollutant record company people in this and really super wealthy people. It's like, I notice you have a lot more fun with more of your, you know, for lack of a better term, again, your average type person. Mm-hmm. And he definitely confirmed that. Mm-hmm. See, I believe he's from a small town in Utica. So he was a very salt of the earth kind of guy who had done a lot and seen a lot of, you know, again, for lack of a better term, my favorite phrase tonight, high pollutant kind of situations.
High rollers, movers and shakers.
You know, another guy that I've spent a lot of time with and gotten to know quite well is Robin Zander from Cheap Trick. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Same thing. Salt of the earth guy who comes from a small town. And I'm here to tell you, Robin Zander's Midwest accent is still stronger than mine. Yeah. He's like, hey there, Bryn, how's it going? And I'm like, Robin, you've been traveling the world for 40 years and you're still like going, hey, what do you say? We get some beers.
Oh gosh, we got to fire up that snow blower. The cold weather coming in for sure.
Yeah. So, you know, so Bill and I started at that point when he saw something that I didn't and frankly had more confidence in my ability in that area than I did. So he just seemed like the right choice.
You know, John, you know, this is definitely one of my favorite questions here. So how does it feel, you know, for you to go from discovering Flip, then loving them, you know, becoming a fan, and then working with them? So how does it feel, and what are some of the great experiences that you had working with not only Bryn, but with the whole group? So how does it feel?
Be nice.
Bryn is a total... No. It's not going too far to say in its own small way, it's been a fan's dream come true. It's this is a cliche. You've heard other people say in interviews, they always say, don't meet your heroes. But I met my heroes and everything was like, it was great. They're not my heroes. I appreciate them as artists. I love what they did. Flip, for anybody out there who has not already listened to Flip, buy the book or don't buy the book, but get their music. Because if you already like Kiss, if you like Cheap Trick, if you like that kind of power, poppy, but you know, Cheap Trick has a sense of humor about them. Flip has that too, but they're talking about something without being preachy or heavy-handed. I just found so much in that band. And I remember deciding to see if I could contact them to see about this book. And I texted Bryn and I said to my wife, I'll give it a shot. She goes, what do you got to lose? And then Bryn responded very quickly and we started talking. And then after a couple interviews, I was thinking, I wonder if this book's actually going to happen. And she said, well, you had no expectation that they'd respond to you, and they did. And a true, and I don't mean a silly, heart-pounding fan who wants to, tear a piece of your shirt off and save it as a souvenir, but somebody who admires their work. And you really get to meet them. And I have to say, I have four new friends. People who will just call me during the week and say, what's up? The book's already done. They're still calling me and saying, so what you doing? And I'll call Bryn and say, so what's going on? For the Kiss fans in your podcast, imagine that you have the opportunity to talk to Gene or Paul or Ace or Peter, and it becomes a conversation. And you have another conversation, and you have another conversation, and they're not going to earn any money out of it. And God knows I may or may not earn any money out of this. I don't think I'm going to retire on this book, but now you're friends. And as Bryn said at the very start of this, I want to say at my age, at any age, to my 12-year-old students at home, I'll say, because they're going to watch this. I'm glad we haven't said any nasty words.
Hope.
There's no age at which you can afford to walk away from a possible real friendship. And the older you get, as my interviewers will probably agree, that becomes more precious. Two of my best friends in the world were my traveling companions when I did all my science research, a generation older than me. They're both now 91. They were still climbing waterfalls in the jungle with me when they were 85 years old. But what I see, knowing them, and I visit them all the time, one by one, their friends are either passing away or succumbing to Alzheimer's. They're losing their friends. And so it underscores for me, there's never any time like the present to make new friends. And here I've made four new friends out of my favorite band in the world. Who wouldn't find that a joyous occasion? A joyous occasion. And because of these people who have touched so many other people in the music industry, not just, Bill LaCoin, but Eddie Kramer and, the producer for Aerosmith, who Bryn has worked with, and, all these other people. Bryn's brother Kai produced videos for Ringo Starr and Elton John. There's even the possibility that other projects might be in the work. And as I'm at the age where I might retire from teaching, to be making new friends in this area of life that everybody who watches your podcast loves the music. And an absolute thrill. It has brightened my life so much. And when I sent a sample copy of the book to Bryn, I wrote something to the effect of, this new friendship with Bryn has been one of the highlights of the year, and the book has just been a nice bonus. And that's the truth.
Nice. Wow. That's awesome. That's lovely. That's so nice.
It isn't, that isn't that a nice dissertation on the power of rock and roll bringing
Yeah.
people
There
together?
you go. There you go.
It's cool. It's like it really is a common ground, and just like I spoke to earlier, when any of us in junior high school or high school went to a new friend's house and you look through the record, that's what you're looking for, is common ground. It's what you want. So, yeah, it's not lost on me at all. To the point where the book is kind of like icing on the cake.
Yeah,
Like
exactly.
when John comes to town and stays with me at my house for the book signing thing, when he gets off the plane and I give him a big hug, I'm going to be more interested in taking him to White Castle than talking about the book.
Yeah.
That's true. That's true.
I
That's
mean,
friendship.
yeah. So it'll be that, and then with the book. But yes,
right.
The book is almost like a monument to their work and the friendship that was established, and what it did for my writing, not career, but my writing as an art, and their music as a testimony to what they did.
Yeah.
You know, I don't want to put words in anybody's mouth, but I'm willing to bet that for the members of Flip, it must have been a kick to run into a complete stranger who 15 years after the fact said, I want to memorialize your work. And the friendship that comes from that is just, who wouldn't love somebody to come up to you and say, I appreciate what you dedicated your life to.
Well, I can tell you that. If the guy was a total K-12 year old, not nice person.
Thank you.
Then it would be terrible.
Yeah.
But that's not the case. So it's not terrible. So that element is actually, you know, let us not take that for granted.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. That's the most important thing. Yeah.
John, you talk about the band and your book with such passion. Were there any challenges to writing this book? Was it work at all for you?
It was pure recreation. It was really fun. I would come home from work. I have to say my wife was very good. She was a book widow for a little while. But I would come home and I'd say, got a Zoom meet with Cherry Forever. And, you know, at 8 o'clock. So you watch your show. And I'm going to do this and keep the barking dog out of the room. And we do that. And then maybe the next day, you know, when you're a teacher, you have a couple class. I teach six sessions a day. I have two sessions to myself. And I would download the video and I transcribe a little bit. And I do. The book came up very, very fast. You know, when I'm writing like one of my own travel narratives.
I love that.
They typically take about a year and a half of somebody's spare time, you know, who has a day job. This book, from the moment I started to the moment it was ready to go to press, was 8 months. It was really quick. And I wouldn't just attribute that to the casual observer might say, well, yeah, you just took everybody else's words. There's a lot of craft in taking other people's words and filtering them down to make a narrative that makes sense. Mm-hmm. People in an interview don't talk in a linear fashion. They don't talk in a chronological fashion. And there's going to be repetition and all this stuff. But it was just so much fun. No challenge at all. The challenges were all positive ones. Like a painter with a blank canvas, a recording artist popping off the cellophane off a new reel of tape. It was like, wow, here we go. It was that kind of challenge. It was fun, 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 fun. Nice. And I really hope that that comes through in the book. The people who've read it so far just say it's really fun. I think one of my favorite compliments was by Eric Bobeja, the backup guitarist currently in the band, who said it was fun and all that. He said it was honest.
Mm. Okay.
I really like that. Mm-hmm. And I responded to his post by saying, I really want people to know that the band didn't exercise any control over it. They really trusted me. I published this without them seeing the final product. And they're selling it with no reservations. So listen, wouldn't we all love that in our jobs?
Absolutely.
We all love that our boss just trusts us to do it and never asks us how we did it and believes we did a good job.
Yeah.
So this has been a dream come true assignment.
But you know what? Maybe that's exactly why this book is so good, because it's from your own creative endeavor. You had artistic license to create your vision for what you wanted to see.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that, and that they trusted me so much that they were so open. So I got all the cool stuff.
Yeah.
And by the way, Bryn mentioned this very early in the interview, and I think it bears repeating. These four men really, really like each other.
Mm.
There was no dirt to go digging for, and there was no dirt that I had to push aside. There really wasn't. There really wasn't. There was one or two, I have to say, there was one interview I had with somebody who had mixed feelings. And I did represent that in the book, but I didn't emphasize it because it really isn't the major part of this story.
Right.
And so I allowed that voice to be heard, but I didn't make it dominate anything because it didn't dominate anything in real life. But it's there. The book is honest.
Right, right.
And I think we can all sit. It's not a whitewashed job. You know, when you read Paul's book, you know it has Paul's point of view.
Yeah.
And when you
yeah.
read Gene's, you know it's Gene's point of view. And KISS fans know what they're getting. They know Gene's going to be selling, selling, selling. We know that Paul's going to take things very, very personally. We know that Peter has a big chip on his shoulder. But that also means you, but that, and you know that Ace forgets most of it. But that also means with each of those books, there's a little frustration factor. You know, none of those books is going to hit it. I'm very, very glad to say that this book was so, the interviews were so wide open. There was just nothing to exclude.
Having such an amazing time writing this book, do you see yourself doing other bios?
Yeah, I do.
Oh, yeah? Like what?
Well, there is something that Bryn and I are kind of hovering around that would be a really cool project that is probably going to happen. It's a book
nice.
Everybody's been waiting for a long time, but
nice.
I have not put one word to paper yet.
Mm-hmm.
So that has yet to start. And when we started talking about that some months ago, I told the other people involved, I've been really eating, breathing, and sleeping Flip for months. And I really need to totally get this thing to market and know that it's to bed and done. I don't want to be divided at all.
Yeah.
And so it will be, if we take up this next project, that'll be the next thing. I'm already thinking about another band from the Northeast. I won't call them similar to Flip, but there's a similar vibe to it, sort of a small town group that got some national attention, quirky, interesting, creative, very niche. But I'm doing what I did with Flip. I'm starting to get all the music. I'm starting to look at all the interviews. I'm going to really do my homework. And then I'm going to see if I can contact the main dude. And I will probably send him a copy of this so he knows I can do it.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And say, are you interested? But I'm not going to say who it is because I don't want somebody watching this to say, that's a great idea. And they write it first.
Right. Right.
Good one. That's a good one. Bryn, I have a question for you. You know, you've been keeping, you know, very, very active on social media, you know, to keep the Flip brand alive in the consciousness of the fans. So, and of course, you know, the book will continue to do so. So what is coming up in the future of Bryn Ahrens? What are you up to?
Okay, you had to ask.
Waiting for my girl, yes I. Waiting for my girl. Waiting for my girl to change my world. Waiting for my girl. Everything falls
apart. I'm a songwriter. That one I did 2 days ago.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. I just sent by request two songs to Nashville, one called Goddamn Dog. I love my goddamn dog. He's dancing on my leg. He's sniffing up my butt. He's eating all my food. He's sleeping on my bed. He's sitting in my chair. Now get into the truck. We're going for a ride. And then I'll let you outside where you can run, Duke, run. I love my goddamn dog. I just placed a song with Brian Setzer, is now doing a song I wrote called Getting All Trucked Up, Gonna Have Some Fun, I Got the Dog in the Back, We're Gonna Hit and Run, Let's Rev Our Engines Up, We're Getting All Trucked Up, Dum-bum-ba-dum. Getting All Trucked Up with Nowhere to Go, I'm Gonna Find Myself Down in Mexico and Get All Trucked Up. Yeah, we're getting about taking your truck to Mexico and getting it painted all sparkly and get. So songwriting is what I do. I'm gonna guess, since John and I have started talking and I played him a few odds and ends, ten songs since we started. So I've just been offered a solo deal. I'm considering that.
Okay.
But really, I've been really enjoying attempting to write songs for other people.
Oh, nice. Okay.
So that's what I do. And then another thing I've been doing that has come to me very organically is mentoring younger artists.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I've been hired to do that for a lot of very famous people, for their kids' bands and things like that, and have traveled the world doing it. So I'm doing a lot more of that and have learned that I really enjoy it. I really, really enjoy it, helping these people navigate through a business that is forever changing, which makes it semi-unnavigatable, meaning, so the navigation process is also becoming creative and inventive in the way in which you get your stuff out there. Mm-hmm. It's very much like the 1950s when Little Richard's manager would sell records out of the trunk of his car after the show. That's kind of where the music business is at now. So it takes a creative summit, again, for lack of a better term, to try to create a way to get people aware of your group and, mm-hmm. and do things.
Mm-hmm.
And those ways are not, you know, during the late 80s and early 90s, to get in front of a bunch of record companies was usually to have a manager that knew these people, and then you would do like a private showcase situation for all these right. labels. Well, those labels don't exist anymore. Those showcase rooms don't exist anymore. So how do we do this? And I've had great success at it, and am doing it more and more.
Beautiful. So,
and I do an online, on Sunday evenings, a Zoom-style songwriting class with people mm-hmm. all over the world. That are in the class, and that's really fulfilling. So that's still one all music all day.
Nice. That's you, right?
Kind of like MTV, only maybe Bryn TV. I got nothing. But I do live here in Minneapolis, Minnesota, just to be clear.
So, guys, we're going to end this episode by putting you two on the spot in a minute. But before we do that, John, how can fans get a hold of this book?
Oh, right now it's available through Rocksteady Records and Bandcamp. It may ultimately be available through other venues, but for the next several months, that's where you get it. You go to Bandcamp, Rocksteady Records. If anybody goes online and just Googles Flip, thanks for having us, they will mm-hmm. probably find the purchasing arrangement. You buy it online. We're hoping to have a book signing event in Minneapolis at a record store called Down in the Valley, early April. I won't say the date because it's a little fluid, but people should just watch. Look online. If they go to Bryn Ahrens on Facebook, they'll probably get the updates all the time.
Mm-hmm.
There's another well-trodden Facebook site called Bring Back Flip. They check there. They'll probably get updates. And that's where they get it.
Okay.
Fantastic. Now, to put you guys on the spot. So you're going to have 15 or 20 seconds to make an announcement promoting this book. What would you say to the fans? John, we'll start with you.
If you're a fan of Flip or any kind of good power pop, rock and roll in the order of Cheap Trick, Flips, Kiss, the Sex Pistols. This is a book written by the fan, for the fans, spoken in the band's own words. It's a good going fun romp, a lot of laughs, a lot of first person anecdotes. And I hope you'll see that it's written right from the heart, pure love.
Very cool. Bryn, how about you?
But the book is kind of like the title of our last album, Too Dumb to Quit. Of course, that's tongue in cheek. We're not too dumb to quit. We're too smart to stop. Right?
Love
it's,
it.
It's like a marriage. And of course, we hear this comparison, rock bands, marriages, and it gets a little tiresome. But anybody who's had a friend or a partner or a desire, I mean, look at your guys' rooms behind you. It's not an easy task to keep things together. It's not an easy task to keep your kids and everybody buoyant and together, right? To me, the book is about not giving up, about knowing that the prize isn't an award. It isn't the platinum album. The award is in the doing. The reward is in being. The reward is doing what it is that you love. And in my courses, I invented a term called creative currency. Later on in my life, very much based on capital investors, very wealthy individuals who maybe wanted to be a musician or an actor in their younger years, and then became lawyers and doctors, and then retired and have a buttload of money and want to get involved in the film industry or the music industry. And I've worked with plenty of these people. They can throw all the money in the world that they have at making a movie so they can hang out in the dressing room with Johnny Depp, right? Or what have you. But the real value, so even all the money in the world can't buy what we did. You could give me all the money in the world and it would have not assisted me. As a matter of fact, it probably would have been a detriment to us doing what it is that we do. What I am, for lack of a better term, again, if this should be a drinking game, by the way, every time Bryn says for lack of a better term.
It's true.
You'd be under the table.
Word of the day. And where was I going with this? Oh, and I teach this in my classes, that the creative currency, therefore, if I reverse engineer that situation, all the rich people that I've worked with that wanted to be close to the music or film industry, there's a great David Lee Roth line where he says, money doesn't buy happiness, but you can pull your yacht right up next to it. Yeah. And that's the truth. That's what what I hear is the creative currency is actually greater than actual money.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because it can't be bought with money. It can't be manifested with money. And what this book speaks to is four guys loving what it is they do in the face of all odds. And those odds are huge. We're talking about the fucking music business here. Sorry, 12-year-olds. We're talking about the music business here. Has anybody noticed you can't buy stock in the music business?
Mm-hmm.
There's a reason for it, because the business is so forever fluctuating and crazy. So you have to lean on the true value that lies. And the value, again, I'm going to repeat my phrase, is the creative currency. And to me, that's what the book is about. It's kind of like Rocky, but they don't actually win the big match. But they walk away happy, and they're still all friends, and couldn't be more grateful for what we did.
If I can piggyback onto that for 20 seconds, for me as the writer, because you were asking, I'm not gonna retire on the money for this book. The book was the reward.
Right.
It was the meeting and the talking to some of my musical, I don't want to say musical heroes, people I admire greatly.
The process.
That was enough by itself, and it's been a pleasure.
Yeah, that bridge. You know, guys, what a way to wrap up the episode. It's been tremendously enriching for me, and fascinating and fulfilling to spend time with you. And John, you know, such a pleasure to meet you. And Bryn, you know, always nice to see you, my friend. And one thing that I can say before passing the ball to Pask, it's seeing you each other, you know, seeing together how you talk and how you interact, you know, between the two of you guys. I can't think of anybody else better than you, John, to write this book for Flip. And, you know, there's no other band like Flip to write this book about. You know, this has been amazing, amazing.
Thank you so much. It's been such fun.
What I find interesting is that, yes, this is a Kiss podcast, and we've been talking about Flip. But the story of Flip is the story of Kiss. We tell the same story with the same passion. And, you know, Bryn, you were mentioning, you know, Claudio's room in the back and the passion that Kiss fans have. It's fantastic to see your passion, John, for Flip. And that from that came an amazing friendship between the two of you. That's what it's about. That's just an amazing message to send our listeners. So, guys, once again, thank you so much. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Well,
thank you.
If I may say one thing before signing off, thanks for having us.
There we go. Love it. Thank you, guys.
Thank you so much. Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
To the Kiss Army and Flip Army, we hope you enjoyed this episode. If you have any questions, comments, or ideas, please send them to talktome@kissarmynationpodcast.com. Please remember to like and subscribe and help promote the amazing guests we have on the show. Until the next time, remember, never stop rocking. Take care, everyone. If you enjoyed this episode, like and subscribe on YouTube or follow us on Spotify, Podomatic, iHeartRadio, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Don't forget to make yourself heard. Leave us a comment on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram. See you all soon, Kiss Army.